Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really big one. Foundational, you might say, but maybe also deeply misunderstood, the Fifth Commandment.
Honor your father and mother.
Exactly. And what's so striking right off the bat is where it sits in the list. We've talked about God, then the Sabbath, sort of that bridge between God and the world.
Mm-hmm.
But then as we move to how we treat each other, the very first commandment isn't, you know, don't murder.
No.
Or don't steal. It's this one. Honoring parents. That's top of the list for human interaction.
It really sets a priority, doesn't it?
It does. And just think for a second about how different our view of parents often is today compared to, say, the past. You picture those 1950s, 60s TV shows.
Yeah, the father knows best era.
Right. That archetype, the wise dad everyone turned to. But now, so often, you see the Homer Simpson type, you know?
Yeah, the clueless dad.
Clueless, disrespected by the kids, even mocked in commercials sometimes. Constantly outsmarted.
It's funny, but also, says something.
It really does. And it makes you think, especially since parents are... Well, they're usually the first authority figures we ever really know.
You've hit on something really crucial there. That shift, that kind of casual disrespect we sometimes see now towards parents, and maybe authority generally.
Yeah.
It really throws this ancient commandment into sharp relief, doesn't it?
Definitely.
So that's our mission today, really, to dig into what honor actually meant back then in that world.
Yeah.
Why single out parents? Not kings or priests first, but parents.
Right.
And how was this supposed to look in practice? Because as we'll see, the implications were, well, profound, sometimes even a bit unsettling for us today.
Okay, so let's dive right into that. That first big question, what do we even mean by honor? It feels a little vague, maybe, to modern ears. What were they getting at?
Yeah, that's the key. And to get it, we really need to understand this fundamental difference between two types of cultures. Scholars often talk about honor-shame cultures versus merit-guilt cultures. So most Western societies today, like ours, leaned heavily towards merit-guilt. Merit is something you earn. You do good things, you achieve stuff, and you get rewarded. You get standing.
Makes sense.
And guilt. That's internal. It's private. You feel bad because you know you did wrong, even if no one else finds out. It's about your conscience.
Right. I get that.
Now, flip that. The ancient Near East, where the commandments came from, that was overwhelmingly an honor-shame culture.
Okay, so how does that work?
Well, honor isn't just about what you do. It's very much about your public face, your standing in the community. And that comes from your actions, yes, but also, crucially, from your position.
Yeah.
Your age, your family, your status.
So it's external, how others see you.
Exactly. And shame is the flip side. It's when that public honor is denied or lost or taken away. It's a public thing. Think about Haman in the Book of Esther.
Okay. The vizier.
Right. He's got this high position. He expects public deference. Then Mordecai refuses to bow, refuses to give him that public honor. Now, from that cultural perspective, Mordecai was actually breaking the rules.
Even if Haman was a bad guy.
Yeah. Because Haman's position demanded respect. To deny it was a public insult, a shaming. The Hebrew word for honor, kavod, actually means weighty or significant.
Huh. Like you say, someone's a heavyweight.
Precisely. It carries that same idea. Someone whose status gives them weight.
Mm.
So in these cultures, honor is tied very strongly to who you are, an elder, for instance, just because they've lived a long life, maybe even more than what you've specifically done.
Wow. Okay. That really does flip our modern way of thinking, doesn't it? Where we focus so much on individual achievement or character. So it wasn't about earning respect necessarily.
Not in the same way we think of it. Position granted a certain inherent honor.
And here's where I think it gets really startling for us.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that in these cultures, honor could literally be seen as more important than life itself.
Absolutely. That phrase, death before dishonor, that wasn't just melodrama. Losing honor, bringing shame on the family. That could echo for generations. It wasn't just personal. It was corporate.
We still see echoes of this, sometimes in really tragic ways, even today in certain parts of the world. You mentioned that example of Mubin Rahu.
Yes, the young man who killed his own sister for marrying outside her faith. And the father's reaction is just gut-wrenching from our perspective.
He said the family was destroyed, but blamed the daughter, not the son, who killed her.
Right, because in his eyes, she brought the shame, the dishonor. And the son, tragically, was seen as doing the honorable thing to restore the family's public face. And we need to be clear, this isn't tied to one specific religion. It's a dynamic you find in strong honor-shame contexts across different cultures.
It's just hard to comprehend that depth of prioritizing public standing over individual life.
It is for us. but it highlights just how central honor was. Yeah. So bringing it back to the commandment, honoring parents in that world meant treating them according to the weight, the kavod, their position demanded.
Regardless of whether you thought they were good parents or bad parents by some objective measure.
Exactly. Their role itself commanded respect. Their position in the family, in society, demanded a certain kind of treatment.
Okay, that makes sense within that framework. Which leads to the next big question. Why parents? Why are they singled out here, right at the start of our duties to other humans? Why not, you know, the king or the priests or other leaders?
That's a great question. And the reason I think is incredibly profound and foundational. Parents are, for every single one of us, the first people we ever interact with.
True.
They give us life. They protect us, feed us, nurture us, care for us when we're completely helpless. In a very real sense, they act as, let's say, God's surrogates in our earliest years.
Surrogates. Wow.
Yeah. Their ideal role, providing, protecting, guiding, mirrors the role God is meant to have in our lives more broadly as we grow. That initial life-giving relationship is just fundamentally shaping.
Even if they're imperfect.
Even if they're imperfect. The role, the fact that they are the source of our physical existence in early survival, gives them this unique primary place.
Mm-hmm.
It helps explain why the Bible so often uses parental language for God, Father, sometimes even imagery suggesting mother.
That makes a lot of sense. When you frame it like that, as the first representatives of life and authority, you can see why honoring them would be placed so highly. It almost seems like honor should just flow naturally from that, shouldn't it?
You'd think so.
Which naturally brings us to the how. How exactly was this honor supposed to be demonstrated? I imagine it looks different for kids versus adults.
It does. For young children, the clearest expression is obedience. That's emphasized in both the Old and New Testaments. Children, obey your parents.
Okay, straightforward enough.
But the Old Testament took disobedience very seriously. There was actually a law in the book stating that a persistently rebellious, disobedient son could, theoretically, be brought before the elders and stoned to death.
Whoa, stoned for being disobedient. That sounds incredibly harsh. I mean, how could that be justified?
It sounds shocking to us, absolutely. But a couple of things to keep in mind. First, there's virtually no evidence this was ever actually carried out. It seems to have functioned more as the ultimate deterrent.
Like a worst-case scenario threat.
Exactly. It signaled the absolute gravity of undermining that foundational parental authority. In an honor-based society, a child who completely rejected parental authority wasn't just a family problem. They were seen as a potential danger to the whole social fabric. So the extreme penalty underlined the extreme importance of that relationship. It probably made genuinely rebellious children pretty rare.
Okay, context is key there.
But here's something crucial. While obedience applied to kids, the Fifth Commandment itself was arguably written primarily for adults.
For adults, how they should treat their aging parents.
Precisely. Think about ancient households.
Uh-huh.
On multi-generational, the patriarch, the elder, held the position of highest honor. Their word carried immense weight. Now, wise patriarchs would often grant their adult children autonomy. But theoretically, the patriarch could pull rank. They had the authority, backed by societal expectation and potentially severe consequences, to enforce their will, even on grown children living within that extended family unit.
So respect and deference continued long after childhood. What about practical support, material help?
Yes. That's another huge piece of it. And this is where Jesus, in the New Testament, gets really fired up about people shirking their duty.
Right. You mentioned he had some harsh words.
He did. See, the system often worked like this. Parents would give their inheritance, especially land, to their sons earlier in life. The eldest son usually got a double portion.
Okay.
The understanding, the expectation, was that in return, the sons would use that inheritance to support their parents in their old age. It was a kind of intergenerational contract, a social security system.
Sounds like a good system in theory.
In theory, yes. Beautiful, even. Young families get capital, elders get care.
Yeah.
But it was open to abuse. Well, some religious leaders, the Pharisees specifically, had developed this loophole. It got written into their traditions, the Talmud. You could declare your money or property korban.
Korban. What's that?
It means devoted to God or a gift of the temple. Essentially, you'd earmark your assets for God, making them untouchable for any other purpose.
So a son could say, sorry, mom and dad, can't support you. All my money is korban.
Exactly that. It was a way to legally, piously even, get out of the financial responsibility of caring for aging parents. They could let their parents suffer, potentially for years, while holding onto the wealth that was implicitly meant for that very purpose.
Wow, using piety to justify neglect, that's pretty cynical.
It is, and Jesus was furious about it. He called them hypocrites. He accused them of nullifying the clear command of God, honor your parents, which included supporting them for the sake of their human-made traditions.
So for him, the spirit of the law, the actual care and honor, was way more important than the religious technicality.
Absolutely. It was a perfect example, in his view, of how religion could go wrong when it lost sight of love for God and neighbor.
Okay, so financial support was key. Let's bring this forward. What about today? We live longer, families are often spread out, many elderly parents end up in care facilities. What does honor look like then? Is it just about sending a check?
That's such an important question for our time. Obviously, sometimes professional care is the most loving and practical option. But honor goes beyond just ensuring physical needs are met. There's the emotional support, the connection.
Which can be hard when people live far apart.
It can be. But the statistics are pretty sobering. Some studies suggest, you know, maybe 40% of nursing home residents get no visits from family. None at all.
40%? That's staggering.
It is. And the average child apparently visits a parent in a home only maybe twice a year. Is it any wonder that studies also show incredibly high rates of depression among residents, like 30, 40, even 45%? Often it's rooted in profound loneliness.
Just feeling forgotten.
Exactly. I remember something from years ago when I was a younger pastor doing visits. I went into a dementia ward, and this little old lady grabbed my hand tight and looked up at me, her eyes searching my face, and she asked, "Are you my Joey?"
Oh, wow.
And I gently said, no, I wasn't. Later, I asked the nurse about her son, Joey, and the nurse just sighed and said, "He's never visited, not once since she's been here."
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Yeah. Just never visited.
Yeah, it stayed with me. A really stark picture of what the absence of honor, of simple presence, can look like.
It really puts a fine point on that emotional side, doesn't it? Beyond just the practicalities. Now, there's one more aspect you mentioned, honoring parents by preserving traditions. How does that fit in?
Right. This is maybe less obvious to us today, but hugely important in traditional societies.
Mm-hmm.
Part of honoring parents and the generations before them was receiving and passing on the family and community traditions, the wisdom, the stories, the laws.
Like keeping the family history alive.
Yes, and the cultural identity. Now, of course, we have to be discerning. Not all traditions are good or worth preserving. Some need to be challenged or left behind.
Sure.
But the act of intentionally receiving, valuing, and passing on the positive legacies, the wisdom, the skills, the values, the faith, that itself is an act of honor. It acknowledges that those who came before us strove, learned things, built things worth remembering. It connects the generations.
So it's about respecting their accumulated experience and wisdom, not just discarding everything because it's old.
Exactly. It's how a culture maintains continuity and learns from its past, rather than constantly trying to reinvent the wheel.
Okay, that makes sense. Let's circle back then to that promise, or maybe the implied warning attached to the commandment, so that you may long live in the land the Lord your God is giving you. What happens if you don't honor your parents? What's the consequence?
Well, on an individual level, as we saw with the theoretical stoning law, the consequences could be severe, being cut off, potentially meaning premature death or exile from the community.
No.
But there's a bigger corporate dimension, too.
Corporate, meaning for the whole society.
Yes. Dishonoring the foundational relationships, particularly the parental one, was seen as undermining the entire social order, potentially leading to the whole community losing its place, its inheritance symbolized by the land. Think about the story of Noah and his son Ham.
Ah, right. After the flood, Noah gets drunk.
Gets drunk, passes out naked in his tent. Ham sees him, and instead of respectfully covering him or looking away, he goes and tells his brothers, essentially mocking or shaming his father.
Which was a huge taboo, seeing an elder naked like that.
A massive taboo. Deeply shaming. And when Noah finds out, what happens? He curses Ham's descendants. Not Ham directly, but his lineage.
Saying they'd be servants, landless.
Exactly. The act of shaming the father led to a generational loss of inheritance, of place, of stability. It's a powerful mythological statement about the consequences of breaking that foundational honor.
So drawing that out, failing to honor parents, failing to pass on those values and traditions, it's seen as contributing to a kind of societal decay.
That seems to be the implication. It leads to the spread of, well, bad behavior iniquity. It risks forfeiting the collective inheritance, whether that's land or cultural stability or divine favor. Ultimately, it can lead to breakdown in judgment, like the exile from the land that Israel eventually experienced.
That's a heavy connection. It really raises the stakes beyond just personal relationships. Which brings us to today. Does this ancient warning, this connection between honoring elders and societal well-being, have any relevance for us? Paul, in the New Testament, clearly thought the commandment itself was still vital.
He did. And, you know, purely from a sociological perspective, you do have to wonder, how long can a society thrive if it consistently devalues the experience of its elders, if it forgets its traditions, loses its historical moorings?
If each generation thinks it knows better than everyone who came before.
Right. How far can that go before things start to fray?
Yeah.
This isn't about saying elders are always right or that traditions should never change. But it is suggesting that there's value, there's wisdom, there's stability in honoring those who've lived longer, who've strived, who've built the foundation we stand on.
Treating them not as an embarrassment or irrelevant, but as, well, heavyweights, people deserving of kavod.
Exactly. Deserving of honor, if only we're willing to listen and give it. It's definitely a challenging thought for our time.
It really is. A lot to chew on there. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Fifth Commandment. It's certainly given me, and hopefully you listening, a lot to think about regarding its profound and maybe challenging meaning for our lives today.
It's a conversation worth having.
Absolutely. Maybe just take a moment after this to think about the elders in your own life, the traditions you've inherited. Is there a connection there worth strengthening? Some wisdom to tap into? Something worth honoring? Food for thought. Thanks for listening.